Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
And honestly, today's going to be a really fun one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what if I told you that the ultimate cheat code for like surviving the most stressful exam of your life or keeping your cool in a million-dollar business negotiation was actually invented by a guy in a toga over 2,000 years ago?
I'd say you've been reading today's source material pretty closely.
Guilty as charged. Yeah, today we are undertaking a deep dive into Article 39 from our collection. The title of the text is Stoicism in Ancient Philosophy.
Right, and it's a fascinating journey. We're going from the dusty streets of ancient Athens straight to the modern corporate boardroom.
And even onto the therapist's couch, you know? It's crazy how relevant this stuff is.
It really is a remarkable progression to trace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for you listening right now, encountering a humanities passage on the TOEFL, especially one dealing with ancient philosophy, it can sometimes feel like hitting a wall of abstract concepts.
Oh, for sure. It feels like you're just reading a different language sometimes.
Exactly. So our mission in this deep dive is to completely deconstruct that wall. We're going to examine the core logic of Stoicism and really extract that high-level C1 academic vocabulary that populates this specific text.
But, and this is key, we are not just going to rely on rote memorization today, right?
No, absolutely not. Memorizing a list of definitions out of context is, well, it's just ineffective, especially when you are under the strict time constraints of a standardized test.
Right, your brain just goes blank.
Exactly. Instead, we're going to explore the historical roots of these words, the psychological mechanisms they describe, and really look at the underlying argumentative structure of the reading passage itself.
Because when you understand how the concepts actually function, the vocabulary just naturally anchors itself in your memory. You won't be able to forget it, even if you try.
That is the goal.
Okay, so let's jump right in. We are going to start exactly where the reading passage starts, which is setting the historical stage.
A very important first step.
Right. So the author introduces Stoicism as an ancient philosophical school, and it tells us it was founded in Athens by Zeno of Citium, in the early 3rd century BCE.
Right, 3rd century BCE.
But you know, the phrase philosophical school can trigger a very specific modern image in our minds. Like, if I hear the word school, I am immediately picturing like a brick building, right?
That syllabus, maybe a teacher standing at a chalkboard.
Yeah, exactly. And students sitting in neat little rows taking standardized tests. But applying that modern framework to ancient Athens is, well, it's a huge trap when reading historical texts.
It is a massive trap. And understanding this distinction provides, honestly, crucial background knowledge for any humanities passage you might face.
So what did a school actually look like back then?
Well, in the Hellenistic period, so the early 3rd century BCE, a philosophical school was not an institution. There was no registrar's office or tuition fees.
You know. Yeah, student loans.
Right, no student loans. The word school in this context refers to a distinct system of thought, or just a specific community of thinkers. Zeno of Citium did not lecture in a closed classroom.
Where did he go then?
He actually gathered with his followers in a public colonnade in Athens. He was known as the Stoa Poikile, which translates to the painted porch.
Wait, really? Just a porch?
Just a porch. And that physical location, the Stoa, is actually where the word Stoicism comes from.
That is wild.
Yeah, they were literally just the people who hung out on the porch discussing the nature of the universe.
Okay. That paints a much more dynamic picture for me. So they're standing in the middle of this bustling, noisy, ancient city, right? You've got merchants selling goods, politicians arguing nearby.
Total chaos.
Right. Amidst all of this chaos, they are trying to answer the fundamental question of how to live a good life. It makes the whole concept feel so much more grounded.
It does. It wasn't an ivory tower. It was street-level philosophy.
So let's look closely at the word philosophical, because the author uses it to categorize this entire movement. It's an adjective we encounter constantly, but I feel like its etymology, its history, reveals exactly what Zeno and his followers were actually doing on that porch.
It really does. When we dissect the Greek roots of the word philosophical, it breaks down into two distinct halves that basically illuminate the entire discipline.
Okay, break it down for us.
So the prefix is philo, which translates to a profound affinity or essentially love for something.
You're like philanthropy.
Exactly. You encounter this root in numerous English words. Philanthropy combines philo with anthropos, which means humanity.
Oh, so literally a love of humanity.
Right, usually expressed through charitable giving. Now, the second half of our word is sophia, which translates to wisdom.
Love of wisdom.
Exactly. At its foundational level, to be philosophical is to possess a love of wisdom. It is an active, continuous pursuit of understanding rather than just, you know, passively receiving information.
And knowing that root just makes the entire word family so accessible for you. Like, if philosophical is the adjective describing the nature of the thought, then philosophy is the noun for the subject itself.
The actual love of wisdom.
Right. And the person engaged in that pursuit, like Zeno, is a philosopher.
Which brings up a great point for test strategy. Grasping these suffixes is critical for the reading comprehension section.
Oh, absolutely.
When you encounter a word ending in isical, your brain should immediately categorize it as an adjective. And when you see the -ser suffix, you're almost always dealing with the human agent performing the action.
It's like a shortcut for your brain. Now, furthermore, the passage notes that Zeno founded this school in Athens. And I really want to highlight this because it brings up an essential piece of B1, B2 vocabulary that frequently causes hesitation.
Ah, yes. The verb here is not the past tense of to find.
Right. Let's clarify that distinction because it is a classic linguistic hurdle for English learners. If I lose my car keys and later locate them under the couch, I say, I found my keys.
Because the infinitive verb there is to find. And the past tense is found.
Exactly. However, the text says, Zeno founded the school. You don't just stumble upon a complex system of thought hidden under a rock on a porch, you know?
No, you don't. The infinitive verb the author is using here is actually to found.
So what does that mean in this context?
To found something means to establish it, to create the base or the structure of a completely new entity.
Yeah.
Actually shares the same Latin root fundos, meaning bottom or base, as the word foundation.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. So when you found an organization or a city or a philosophical school, you are literally laying the very first bricks of its intellectual or physical foundation?
Precisely. You are the founder.
Got it. You know, if we contextualize ancient Athens in the 3rd century BCE using a modern lens, we could kind of view it as the Silicon Valley of the ancient world.
I like that comparison. How so?
Well, Silicon Valley is this concentrated geographic hub, right? Where brilliant, ambitious minds migrate to collaborate, compete, and innovate in the realm of technology.
They're writing code to build new software.
Exactly. Athens functioned in much the same way. But instead of coding computer software, individuals like Zeno were innovating the software of human existence.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, they were developing new operating systems for the human mind, attempting to optimize how we process adversity, grief, success, all of it.
And that is a very apt framework for understanding the text's transition into the actual tenets of the philosophy. The passage outlines the specific operating system that Zeno developed.
Okay, let's get into the recipe. What's the core of it?
It states that Stoicism emphasizes rationality and self-control as the primary path to what the author calls a virtuous life.
The text establishes a very deliberate logical sequence here, I noticed. It's a chain of cause and effect that leads directly to the core of Stoic practice.
It does. But before we analyze the links in that chain, we need to unpack the terminology. Let's start with rationality. This is a cornerstone C1 academic term.
Yeah, we see this word everywhere in academic texts.
Right. The noun rationality derives from the Latin root ratio, which fundamentally means reason or calculation. Now, many English learners are highly comfortable with the B1 level adjective logical.
Sure, like if an argument makes sense step by step, it's logical.
Exactly. If it follows a clear progression without contradictions. But rationality operates on a higher, more comprehensive academic tier.
How so? What's the difference?
It refers to the overarching quality, or the state of being guided consistently by reason, logic, and objective analysis, rather than being swayed by impulsive emotions, biases, or unfounded assumptions.
It's like a whole worldview, not just a single argument.
Exactly.
Okay, so Zeno is arguing that the ultimate goal is a virtuous life, and the vehicle to get there is rationality. Now, the word virtuous can sound somewhat archaic or maybe overly religious to modern ears.
It can, definitely.
Yeah. But in the context of classical humanities, it has a very specific secular weight to it, doesn't it?
It does. Virtuous originates from the Latin virtus, which for the ancients encompassed a really broad spectrum of moral excellence, courage, and character. It was about fulfilling your potential as a rational human being.
So how does the suffix play into it?
The word is formed by taking the noun virtue and adding the suffix, virtus. In academic English, the uritus suffix universally means full of or characterized by.
Okay, so like a hazardous environment is full of hazard.
Right, a courageous individual is full of courage. And a virtuous life is a life characterized by moral excellence and integrity.
Beautiful. Okay, so moving on, the author then introduces a massive philosophical premise. The text states that the Stoics believe the universe itself is governed by reason.
That's a huge claim.
Right. Let's examine that collocation, governed by. We are all familiar with the noun government, you know, the political body that writes laws and administers a state.
Right. But when utilized as a verb, to govern means to direct, to control, or to regulate the operations of a system.
So in a normal academic text, you might see, like, a society is governed by laws.
Or a market is governed by supply and demand. Here, however, the text presents a much more abstract, metaphysical concept. The entire universe is governed by reason.
So what did they actually mean by that?
The Stoics believed that the cosmos is not just a chaotic, random sequence of accidents. Mm. Instead, they posited that there is an underlying, rational order, a fundamental logic that dictates how absolutely everything in the universe operates.
From the orbit of the planets to the turning of the seasons.
On their joy.
Okay, let me synthesize the logical chain the author is building here, because, you know, identifying these cause and effect structures is vital for answering TOEFL inference questions.
Highly vital, yes.
So step one. The universe is not random. It is governed by an inescapable rational order. Step two, humans possess the unique capacity for rationality.
Following so far.
Step three, according to the text, if we use our rationality to understand how the universe actually works, we can align with nature.
And that alignment leads to the ultimate outcome promised by the philosophy, which the author identifies as achieving inner tranquility.
Okay, let's hold on that word for a second. Tranquility. Because it is a premium, high-frequency C1 vocabulary word, it carries a much deeper resonance than merely saying someone is, you know, calm.
Oh, it represents a profound psychological state, and we can decode its depth through its Latin origins.
I love when we do this. What are the roots?
So the prefix trans means over, across, or beyond. We see this operative in words like transport, which means to carry across.
Or transcend, to climb beyond.
Exactly. Now, the root quaequils translates to quiet, or rest. Therefore, tranquility is not just a temporary pause in noise. It is a state that extends beyond mere quietness.
So it's not just like taking a nap in the silent room.
No, it describes a deep, overarching, unshakable peace that permeates the mind. It is an internal stillness that remains intact, regardless of the external chaos happening around you.
The outcome sounds ideal. I mean, who doesn't want unshakable peace? But I have a serious point of contention with the mechanism the author describes here.
Oh, part?
I want to look closely at the phrase align with nature, because if I'm a test taker reading this under pressure, my modern vocabulary triggers might lead me totally astray.
How so? What do you picture?
Well, when you or I hear the word nature today, we think of organic ecosystems, right? We picture hiking through a dense pine forest, observing wildlife, escaping the industrial city.
Oh, getting back to nature.
Exactly. So does the text imply that Zeno's solution for achieving inner tranquility was for the citizens of Athens to just abandon their homes, wander into the wilderness, and live like hunter-gatherers? Because that contradicts the whole idea of a sophisticated, rational philosophy.
That is a phenomenal analytical observation. And honestly, it pinpoints exactly how standardized test questions are designed to catch readers who rely on superficial definitions.
So what are they missing?
The author is using nature in its classical philosophical sense, not its modern environmental sense. I must look back to the preceding sentence for the context. The universe is governed by reason.
Ah, okay.
In Stoicism, nature is synonymous with that rational order of the universe. It refers to the fundamental laws of reality, the undeniable facts of how existence functions.
Oh, wow. Okay, that reframes the entire concept.
Yeah.
So aligning with nature doesn't mean moving to a cabin in the woods and hugging trees.
Definitely not.
It means aligning your internal expectations with the external reality of how the universe actually operates.
Right.
You are calibrating your mind to accept the facts of existence rather than throwing a tantrum because reality doesn't conform to your personal desires.
Exactly. You are using your rationality to observe the mechanics of the world and adjusting your behavior to match those mechanics.
I can actually visualize this through a physical analogy.
Let's hear it.
Okay, imagine you are submerged in a massive, fast-moving river. And this river represents the nature of the universe, right? It has its own immense volume, its own unrelenting current, and its own inevitable direction.
Governed by the laws of physics.
Right. Governed by physics. And it does not care about your personal preferences. So if you decide that you want the river to flow the other way and you try to swim upstream against the current, you are fighting the fundamental nature of the water.
That's not going to end well.
No. You will exhaust all your energy, you will inhale water, you will panic, and ultimately you will drown. You are suffering because you are in a state of resistance to reality.
But if you apply rationality to the situation.
Right. If you use your rationality, you recognize that the river's current is objectively stronger than you are. That is a fact. So you turn your body around and swim with the current.
You align yourself with the flow.
Yes. You align yourself with nature. You are still swimming. You are still navigating around rocks and obstacles. But you are no longer fighting the unstoppable force of the river itself.
And the result of that.
Because you have aligned with reality, your panic subsides, you conserve your energy, you achieve a state of physical and mental tranquility, not because the river stopped moving, but because you stopped fighting the way it moves.
That analogy perfectly encapsulates the core thesis of the reading passage. The universe is going to unfold the way it unfolds. The Stoic realizes that exhausting oneself by raging against the current of reality is just entirely irrational.
It's just a waste of energy.
And this realization acts as the perfect bridge into the central defining doctrine of the entire philosophy, which the author introduces in the subsequent paragraph.
Right, the golden rule. The passage states, central to Stoic philosophy is the dichotomy of control. Some things are within our control while others are not.
This sentence is the operational pivot of the entire text.
It provides the practical instruction manual for how to actually swim with the current. But before we get to the manual, we really must conquer the term dichotomy.
Yes, we must.
It is a heavy, intimidating C1 noun that often paralyzes readers when they encounter it in an academic context. I know I used to freeze up when I saw it.
It does look imposing on the page, but its etymology is incredibly elegant and precise. It derives from Greek. The prefix di means two.
And we encounter this constantly in scientific and academic language, right? Like a dialogue is a conversation between two people.
Exactly. Or carbon dioxide is a molecule containing two oxygen atoms.
Okay, so diem is two. What about the rest of the word?
The second half of the word stems from the root tanal, which means to cut. We actually see this root in the word anatomy, which means to cut open, or the word atom.
Wait, atom has that root?
Yes. Ancient scientists believed an atom was the smallest possible particle of matter, so they named it atom, meaning uncuttable.
Oh my goodness, that is fascinating. I never knew that. So if di means two and tom means to cut, a dichotomy is literally the act of cutting something into two distinct, mutually exclusive parts.
Precisely. It's a framework for categorization. In academic discourse, you will frequently encounter collocations like a false dichotomy.
What does that mean exactly?
That occurs when an author argues that a situation presents only two possible options, when in reality there's a whole spectrum of choices. Another common phrase is the dichotomy between theory and practice.
Got it. And here the author is introducing the dichotomy of control.
Yes. The Stoics take the infinite, overwhelming complexity of human existence and ruthlessly slice it into two absolute categories.
Okay, so category one contains the things that are within our direct control. Category two contains the things that are entirely outside of our control. According to the passage, what actually belongs in category one?
The text is very strict about this limitation. The only elements firmly inside category one, our sphere of control, are our own deliberate actions, our own conscious thoughts, and our own choices.
That's it. Just actions, thoughts, and choices.
That is it. And the passage argues that directing our mental energy and focus exclusively toward this category leads to a peaceful and contented life.
But, you know, the friction of human life exists in category two. What happens when we are confronted with events that we cannot control?
The text provides a powerful directive for that. Events outside one's control should be accepted with equanimity.
Okay, I really want to highlight equanimity because it might be the most valuable vocabulary acquisition from this entire deep dive. It is the ultimate psychological goal of the philosophy, basically compressed into a single noun.
It is a paramount C1 term. And it's heavily favored by standardized test writers. Let's dissect the Latin components.
Let's do it.
The first half is equus, which translates to even, level, or equal. We use this root constantly in words like equation, equator, or equality.
Right. And the second half?
The second half is animus, which translates to mind, spirit, or soul. We see it in the word animated, describing someone who is full of lively spirit.
So when you fuse those two components together, equus and animus, you literally get an even mind.
Yes. Equanimity is the capacity to maintain an undisturbed, level, balanced state of mind. Particularly when you are placed under extreme stress or facing adverse circumstances.
Your mind just stays steady.
Right. Your mind does not spike into panic, nor does it plunge into despair. It remains an even horizontal line.
Okay, let me push back on this concept a little bit, because I can totally hear a skeptic arguing against this interpretation of equanimity.
Okay, lay it on me.
Let's use a highly relatable scenario for our listeners. Imagine you have spent 6 months preparing for the TOEFL, right? You have sacrificed your weekends, you have memorized thousands of words, and test day finally arrives.
High stakes.
Very high stakes. You walk into the testing center, sit down at the computer, and the air conditioning system completely fails.
Oh, no.
It is the middle of summer, and the temperature inside the testing room quickly climbs to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, or roughly 35 degrees Celsius. It is sweltering, uncomfortable, and highly distracting.
A nightmare scenario.
Right. Now, if I simply sit there, sweating profusely, and say to myself, well, the broken AC is outside my control, I must accept it with an even mind, isn't that just being passive?
I see where you're going with this.
Doesn't the dichotomy of control basically train people to be pushovers who refuse to advocate for themselves? How does Stoicism differentiate between rationally accepting reality and just giving up?
That is the most sophisticated critique of Stoicism. And it is absolutely crucial to clarify how the philosophy in the text answers it. The dichotomy of control does not mandate passivity. It mandates the hyper-efficient allocation of your resources.
Okay, explain that. Let's run my test center scenario through this Stoic algorithm.
All right. Category 2, two things outside your control, is the mechanical failure of the air conditioning unit. You are not an HVAC technician. You cannot magically repair the machinery from your desk.
True.
If you spend your cognitive energy agonizing over how unfair the heat is, raging internally at the building management, and panicking about how the sweat is ruining your concentration, you are attempting to control the uncontrollable.
Which is irrational.
It's highly irrational. And it guarantees you will perform poorly on the reading section because your working memory is completely hijacked by anger.
You are fighting the river current.
Exactly. Now, let's look at category 1. The things within your control. Your actions are within your control. Raising your hand, calling the proctor over, and calmly filing an official complaint or requesting a fan is an action entirely within your control.
So a Stoic would do that.
The Stoic takes that action immediately. However, and this is the critical distinction, the result of that action, whether the proctor actually brings a fan or whether the test is canceled, is placed back into category 2.
Ah, because you can't control the proctor.
Exactly. It is outside your control.
Yeah.
You take the most rational action available to you, but you detach your emotional stability from the outcome.
Wow.
You maintain equanimity because you know you executed the only part of the equation you actually possessed power over, your own response.
That is a profound distinction. It is not about ignoring the heat or pretending you enjoy being uncomfortable. It is about refusing to suffer twice.
Suffering twice, yes.
The physical heat is a primary adversity. By complaining internally and losing your focus, you are artificially generating a secondary psychological adversity. The Stoic accepts the primary adversity with an even mind and deploys 100% of their cognitive bandwidth toward answering the test questions.
Which is the only thing that actually impacts their score.
Exactly.
And, you know, the author of the passage clearly recognizes the modern utility of this ancient framework because the text executes a really structural transition in the second paragraph.
Right. It shifts gears.
It does. The narrative moves forward 2,000 years, transporting us from the Stoapoikile in Athens directly into the contemporary corporate world. The passage introduces a concept utilized in modern business, referring to it as the Stoic pause.
Yes, the Stoic pause. The text defines this as the internal deliberation to insert a moment of reflection before reacting emotionally. And it notes that this is a highly effective technique employed by executives and business leaders during high-stakes negotiations.
It's a very practical application.
So let's abstract the academic vocabulary here, starting with internal deliberation. We know internal means taking place inside the mind, but deliberation is a remarkably nuanced noun.
It really is. The depth of deliberation is revealed through its Latin root, librare, which means to weigh.
To weigh.
Yes. This root is visually represented by the astrological sign Libra, which, as you might know, is symbolized by a set of balancing scales.
Oh, that immediately conjures an image of the scales of justice for me.
Exactly. When you engage in deliberation, you are essentially setting up a mental scale. You are carefully, methodically placing different options, arguments, or potential consequences on opposite sides of the scale to weigh their relative merits before making a final decision.
It is the absolute opposite of a knee-jerk, impulsive reaction.
Precisely.
And the text specifies that this internal weighing process is critical during high-stakes negotiations. This is a fantastic C1 collocation that regularly appears in both business and academic English. Let's clarify what high stakes implies for our listeners.
The term originates from the world of gambling and wagering. In a game of poker, for instance, the stakes refer to the actual amount of money placed on the table. It's the assets you are risking and the potential reward you stand to gain.
Okay, so if you are playing a low-stakes game with friends, you might be risking pennies. The outcome doesn't significantly impact your life at all.
Right.
But a high-stakes game implies that millions of dollars, or perhaps someone's entire livelihood, is on the line. When we migrate that term into the corporate environment, a high-stakes negotiation is a meeting where the survival of a company, a massive merger, or a vital international contract just hangs in the balance.
The pressure is astronomical, and the margin for error is zero.
So I want to explore the mechanics of this stoic pause during those high-stakes moments. From a psychological perspective, what is actually happening when a business leader utilizes this pause? Is it just like taking a deep breath to calm the heart rate?
It's much more than that.
Because if it is just basic breath work, the phrase internal deliberation feels a bit grandiose.
The author's use of internal deliberation is very deliberate, because the stoic pause is fundamentally a cognitive intervention, not just a physiological one. Let's map it onto the neurology of an argument.
Okay, let's map it out.
During a tense negotiation, the opposing party might insult your company or make a deliberately aggressive lowball offer designed to infuriate you. When that stimulus hits your brain, the amygdala, the emotional processing center, flares up immediately,
urging you to lash out, yell, or storm out of the room.
Yes, that is the biological impulse.
It's the river current trying to sweep you away.
Precisely. And if you react in that fraction of a second, you have surrendered control to an emotion. You've abandoned rationality completely.
So what does the stoic pause do?
The stoic pause is the act of forcefully inserting a wedge of time, even just 2 seconds, between the external stimulus and your internal response. In that brief window, you transfer processing power away from the emotional amygdala and into the prefrontal cortex, which handles logical reasoning.
You execute an internal deliberation.
Exactly. You weigh the options. Will screaming at this person help secure the contract? Is there an insulting tone within my control? No. What is within my control? My counteroffer. You have utilized reason to override impulse.
You know, it functions exactly like the mute button on a video conferencing call.
Now that's a brilliant modern equivalent.
Imagine you are in a high-stakes virtual meeting and someone delivers a completely unreasonable demand. Your visceral immediate reaction is to verbally attack them. If your microphone is live, that unfiltered emotion broadcasts to everyone, the relationship shatters, and the negotiation fails.
Complete disaster.
But the stoic pause is a cognitive mute button. You press mute. You allow the wave of anger to wash over you, but you deny it an exit vector. In the safety of that muted silence, you deliberate.
You weigh the options.
Yes. You calculate the most advantageous, rational response. Only after you have aligned your strategy with reason do you unmute yourself and speak with total equanimity.
That analogy brilliantly illustrates how ancient philosophy becomes a highly tactical modern tool. You are creating a firewall between feeling and emotion and acting upon it.
It's incredibly empowering.
It is. And this concept of examining and intercepting our own thought processes leads us directly into the third and final major transition of the reading passage.
From the boardroom to the clinic.
Exactly. The author moves from history to business and finally into the realm of clinical psychology. The text states that Stoic principles have been heavily incorporated into cognitive behavioral therapy.
Let's address the vocabulary first. The passage says these ancient principles are incorporated into modern therapy.
Yes, the verb to incorporate is built around the Latin root corpus, meaning body. We see this root in words like corpse, referring to a deceased body, or corporation, which is a legal body composed of multiple individuals working together.
So what does it mean to incorporate an idea?
It means to absorb it, to integrate it so deeply that it becomes a functional part of a larger body of work or system. The author is signaling that Stoicism isn't just a loose inspiration for modern psychology. Its core mechanics are actively embedded within the body of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Now, cognitive behavioral therapy is frequently abbreviated as CBT, and it is arguably the most widely practiced evidence-based psychotherapy in the world today. But what exactly is the connection to Zeno of Citium?
The passage provides the crucial link. It says, patients are encouraged to learn to identify and challenge irrational thoughts so that they can change their emotional responses.
I really want to highlight the word irrational because it demonstrates how academic texts build upon their own internal vocabulary.
It is a textbook example of vocabulary compounding on the TOEFL. In the first paragraph, the author established the concept of rationality, the state of being guided by objective reason. Here, we encounter the exact opposite.
Right, the prefix.
Yes. The prefix R is a negative prefix, meaning not. Therefore, an irrational thought is a cognition that is fundamentally unmoored from reason, logic, or objective reality. It is a thought generated by fear, bias, or a distorted perception of the world.
If we unpack the mechanism of CBT as described by the text, it is genuinely revolutionary for anyone who feels victimized by their own anxiety.
It really flips the script.
It does, because the standard assumption most people operate under is that external events directly cause our emotions. I fail a test, therefore I am sad. My boss yells at me, therefore I am angry.
Right, event A causes emotion B.
Exactly. The event occurs, and the emotion is the unavoidable, automatic result. But CBT and Stoicism argue that this model is missing the most important variable.
They argue that there is a hidden middle step. The external event does not cause the emotion. The external event triggers a thought or a belief about the event, and it is that internal thought that generates the emotional response.
The text explicitly states that patients learn to challenge irrational thoughts so that they can change their emotional responses. This implies a profound level of agency.
It means you're in the driver's seat.
Yes. It means our emotions are not just mysterious weather patterns that roll through our minds unchecked. They are the downstream outputs of our own cognitive processing.
Exactly.
If you are experiencing crippling anxiety, CBT suggests that you are likely operating on an irrational thought. And because your thoughts are squarely placed in category one of the dichotomy of control, the things you possess power over, you have the ability to interrogate that thought, dismantle it with reason, and consequently alter the emotion it produces.
And the author provides a highly concrete real-world scenario to demonstrate this psychological mechanism in action, concluding the passage by analyzing the fear of public speaking.
A very common fear.
Very common. The text states, for example, people who fear public speaking can be taught to reframe their anxiety by focusing on preparing for their speech and to expect realistic outcomes.
Let's dissect the verb reframe, because it is the operational mechanism of this final example. The prefix re means again or back, as seen in words like review or rebuild.
Right.
And the root word is frame, which we typically understand as the rigid border surrounding a photograph or a painting.
So when you reframe a photograph, you don't change the actual image, right? The subjects in the photo remain exactly the same.
Nothing inside the picture changes.
However, by putting a different border around it, maybe cropping out certain background elements or shifting the angle of presentation, you fundamentally alter how the viewer perceives the image.
So in psychological terms, what does it mean to reframe a situation?
It means to deliberately shift your cognitive perspective. You're looking at the exact same set of objective facts, but you are placing a new conceptual border around them, which alters the meaning and the emotional weight of those facts.
Okay, let's apply this to the fear of public speaking, which is consistently ranked as one of the most common phobias in the world.
Right up there with heights and spiders.
Literally. And from an evolutionary standpoint, the fear makes sense. If you are standing in front of a large group of people and they are all staring at you in silence, the primitive part of your brain interprets that as a threat.
Because in ancient tribal times, if the group rejected you, you were cast out into the wilderness to die.
Exactly. The physical response, the racing heart, the sweaty palms, the surge of cortisol, is your body preparing to fight or flee.
But the reality of a modern conference room or a classroom presentation is that your physical survival is not actually at risk. The threat is an illusion generated by an irrational thought.
Exactly. The irrational thought is usually some variation of, if I stutter, the audience will think I am incompetent, my reputation will be permanently destroyed, and my career will be over.
Which is a massive leap in logic.
It is. But that thought is what generates the paralyzing anxiety. But let's look at how the text applies the Stoic reframe. If we think of our attention as a highly specialized camera lens, the anxious speaker has their lens focused entirely on the background of the shot.
They are hyper-focused on the audience's facial expressions, whether someone is checking their phone or whether the microphone might suddenly cut out.
And crucially, every single one of those elements belongs in category 2 of the dichotomy.
The uncontrollable.
The audience's reaction and the technical equipment are entirely outside of the speaker's control. By focusing their lens on the uncontrollable, they generate massive psychological suffering.
So how do they reframe it?
The stoic reframe is the act of manually twisting that camera lens. You blur out the audience, you blur out the microphone, you accept that you cannot control them. Instead, you pull your focus sharply into the immediate foreground, locking onto the elements firmly inside category 1.
Which the text explicitly points out, focusing on preparing for their speech.
Yes. You control the depth of your research. You control the clarity of your notes. You control the pacing of your breath. By reframing the event from a performance seeking the audience's approval to an execution of my own preparation, the anxiety is just starved of its fuel.
The external facts haven't changed. You're still giving a speech to a crowd, but your internal emotional state has shifted from panic to equanimity.
Exactly. It's so powerful.
It is a masterful synthesis of the passage. The author concludes the text by demonstrating the practical neurological utility of the dichotomy of control without ever needing to restate the term itself. The transition from ancient theory to modern, verifiable psychological practice is completely realized.
You know, this passage is a structural masterpiece for TOEFL preparation because it weaves history, business, and science into a single cohesive argument.
It really does.
Let's quickly trace the overarching narrative arc of what we just analyzed, because understanding this macrostructure is what allows you to predict questions on the exam.
Sounds like a great way to wrap up. We began our journey in the early 3rd century BCE, navigating the bustling Stoa Poikile in ancient Athens.
Hanging out on the porch.
Right. We were introduced to Zeno of Citium and the foundational premise of Stoicism. The universe is not random, but governed by a supreme rational order, and our goal as humans is to utilize our own rationality to align our expectations with that unavoidable natural reality.
From there, we examined the central engine of the philosophy, the dichotomy of control. We learned that the secret to tranquility involves ruthlessly dividing the world into what we command our actions and thoughts and what we must simply accept.
We saw how resisting the uncontrollable is like fighting a raging river current, leading only to exhaustion and despair.
We then tracked how this ancient operating system was ported into the modern corporate environment. We dissected the stoic pause, the deliberate cognitive intervention used during high-stakes negotiations to weigh options rationally, and short-circuit impulsive emotional reactions.
And finally, we explored the clinical validation of stoicism through cognitive behavioral therapy. We unpacked the mechanism of identifying irrational thoughts and utilizing the technique of reframing to dismantle anxiety, proving that by changing our thoughts, we actively author our own emotional responses.
Now, to lock this knowledge in place, we need to review the 5 critical C1 academic terms that served as the pillars of this passage. We have explored their roots and their applications. Let's solidify their definitions.
All right, rapid-fire vocab review. Term number 1 is tranquility. Derived from the Latin trans meaning beyond and the quies meaning quiet, it represents a profound, unshakable state of inner peace that remains stable despite external chaos.
Perfect. Term number 2 is dichotomy. Built from the Greek di for two and tom meaning to cut, it is the conceptual framework of dividing a complex entity into 2 distinct mutually exclusive categories.
Term number 3 is equanimity. Combining the Latin aquus for even and animus for mind, it is the psychological capacity to maintain a balanced, level, and undisturbed mental state, particularly when enduring severe stress or adversity.
Awesome. Term number 4 is deliberation. Stemming from the Latin liber, meaning to weigh upon a scale, it is the active, internal cognitive process of carefully evaluating options and potential consequences before executing a decision.
And term number 5 is reframe. Utilizing the prefix, again, is a psychological technique of shifting your conceptual perspective, placing a new mental border around an objective set of facts in order to fundamentally alter your emotional response to them.
Those 5 terms are not just vocabulary words, they are the conceptual keys that unlock the entire reading passage.
They absolutely are.
If you comprehend the historical context of Athens, the psychological mechanism of CBT, and the precise meaning of those C1 terms, you will navigate this type of humanities text with absolute confidence.
As we conclude this deep dive, I want to leave you listening with a final provocative thought that extends a bit beyond the boundaries of the TOEFL exam.
Oh, I love these. What do you have for us?
Well, we have spent this entire session analyzing the Stoic and clinical assertion that our emotions are the downstream outputs of our own internal thoughts, rather than the inevitable results of external events.
Right.
If that premise is true, it forces a radical reevaluation of our daily lives. How much of the stress, the anger, and the anxiety that you experience on a daily basis is actually imposed upon you by the outside world, and how much of it is being unnecessarily manufactured by your own irrational thoughts.
Wow. That is a staggering question to carry with you. If we genuinely possess the power to control our thoughts, then a vast percentage of our daily suffering is entirely optional. It is a concept that demands serious internal deliberation. This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.